Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In Brown versus Board of Education, of course, the iconic Supreme Court ruling that it's unconstitutional for there to be separate schools for white and black students. That was in 1954, 63 years ago. Today, about 60% to 80% of school districts, that includes New York and other major cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Dallas, still considered segregated by race and economics by many measures. How did this happen? And what do we do, what do we do about it now? Joining us to help with those answers is Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell, and author of a new book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Thanks for coming on, Professor Rooks. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Can you start by describing segregation as it exists today? I mean, in a way it sounds obvious, but Brown versus Board outlawed the old-fashioned kind where the government just said this is white school, this is black school. So what is segregation today?
Well, one of the surprising sort of open secrets I think that we have is around the country, public school systems really are segregated by race and by economics. We know that some of that has to do with housing patterns, despite the fact that Brown v. Board outlawed state-sanctioned segregation. So you can't have states coming along and saying, you know, it's illegal. We will not educate black students in the same school with white students. Housing patterns mean that for neighborhood schools very often, given the levels of segregation in housing and in whole regions of the country, you have predominantly white neighborhoods, you have predominantly black neighborhoods. But even that, like that's a big factor. But even in the face of the opportunities in places like New York, where you can ask to have your kids move New York City, where you can ask to have your kids, you know, move to one school or another or magnet schools or, you know, have open admissions. The simple fact of the matter is too many wealthy parents choose to only educate their kids with other wealthy kids. Too many white parents make decisions, conscious decisions that sometimes they're conflicted about. You know, sometimes they feel badly that schools with higher numbers of children of color or poor children are not schools that they want their kids in. But it's a combination of policy and simple choice, simple desire.
There's a word in your book, segronomics. What does that mean?
Yeah, so in doing the book, actually, I started in the present. I started in like 2010, really paying some attention to what was going on with privatization and segregation and the big business that was rising up around the $500 to $600 billion a year that constitutes the budget, the state, local, federal budget for public education. And I kept backing up farther and farther, like almost decade by decade, trying to find a period where I wasn't finding the relationships between philanthropists, well-meaning whites, businesses, and poor communities, where there weren't experiments that those groups were coming up with, educational experiments that they were trying out. And I backed all the way up to Reconstruction, which is the beginning of taxpayer-supported education in the South, and realized that those same dynamics were playing out. I had no farther back to go. There was no period of time where I wasn't seeing those same bedfellows and stakeholders gathered together. And so what occurred to me was one of the things that I was looking at that I had not heard about before was the profit in segregation. And I started to wonder, you know, is it time that we ask, is one of the reasons that we're not quickly undoing different forms of educational segregation, is there just too much money in it? Corporations, we just don't want it between individual choice and the amount of money to be made. So the term that I coined is a way of combining the reality of segregation and the reality of big money profit to be made. So it's economics and segregation, and talks about forms of profit that only work In the face of high levels of racial segregation, the business model simply falls apart. A lot of what we're doing in education, if you went to the Princeton Public Schools or Ithaca Public Schools and said, you know, the way that we're going to educate your children is with virtual schools. We're going to put them in front of a computer and they're going to learn that way all day, every day. There'd be a huge uprising. That only works. That's only viable. A viable solution for education is just one example in poor communities and communities that are disenfranchised and vulnerable.
Where are you on charter schools? Because your book title says the end of public education, but proponents emphasize that charter schools are public education.
Right. Yeah, they're privately run and publicly supported. The idea of of charter schools, one of the things, you know, that's undeniable and interesting is that there are very few periods where you haven't had poor communities, black communities, wanting more control over their education, fighting to figure out how to educate their kids. It's not, I don't think that there is anything inherently evil about charter schools. The thing that I do want to at least raise a conversation about and ask the charter industry why they are not more vocal in talking about the fact that pretty generally it's about, I think the last numbers we saw, about 25% or so of charter schools that would be considered high achieving, that would post gain, you know, to the extent that for charter schools the and for public schools and traditional public schools, you know, test scores have become the coin of the realm. So while in earlier periods you might have had a greater kind of metric for what education looked like, today it's pretty much tests. So if you're just talking about tests, there's about 25% of charter schools that are doing better on tests. But that's leaving about 75% that are doing about the same as the traditional public schools, sometimes worse. So undeniably for that 25%, to the extent that you want tests to be the marker mm-hmm. for excellence, they are contributing something. But the entire industry is so poorly regulated that the damage that upwards of 70% are doing, and then if you start to talk about virtual charter schools, which are a form of homeschooling that just through technology, basically, and is a huge growth area, and yet if by this testing matrix is horrendous. So it's not that I'm against charter schools as an entity. What I'm against is the theft of funds from students who, or the inability to fully educate students who need it most, and coming up with idiosyncratic forms of education and educational experiments and saying, let's try them out on this group. We won't get much pushback.
My guest is Cornell American Studies Director Noliwe Rooks, who's the author now of Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. And listeners, we can take some phone calls. Are you a parent grappling with school segregation in your district? Or maybe you know of a school or a district that successfully tackled the issue. 212-433-WNYC with your stories or questions. 212-433-9692. Some of the other examples in your book, before we get into some solutions, and that are local, the Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg matching grant of $100 million to
It was a matching grant, right? So he in 2010 went on the Oprah Winfrey Show with now state senator, then mayor of Newark, Cory Booker, as well as a former mayor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. Governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. And, announced that he was going to make a project out of the Newark public school system, basically. And he was going to put in $100 million. And it was a matching grant. So the folks in the state and local areas had to come up with the other $100 million. And it was a 5-year grant. And at the end of which, you know, he said, well, we will be able to really make some progress around what he, as so many people in and around the so-called ed reform movement, called the civil rights issue of our century, of the 21st century, is unequal education. And the other tagline is really, you know, a child's zip code should not determine the quality of education that they get. So he along with the others, Governor Christie and Mayor Booker, you know, said, so we now have the money. We can do it. We can get this done. $200 million. At the end of 5 years, Mr. Zuckerberg said, you know, that he had learned a lot, but that this was a complete failure. That they had managed to shrink traditional public school systems, which was not actually what he said when they announced. They did not announce that our goal is to shrink the traditional public school system. They said we want to raise achievement. But what they'd done is shrunk the traditional public school system, and they had aggressively expanded charter schools and aggressively expanded the presence of alternatively certified teachers like TFA or teaching fellows. Like, there are a variety of different entities that don't believe in schools of ed and in teaching certification and in teaching as a profession in a way that you need to train people for more than a few months to get it right. So all of those sort of hallmarks of what we do to educate poor children and children of color, rural white children, was what they tried. And at the end of the period, they said, you know, but it didn't work. We did not achieve our goals. And so Mr. Zuckerberg went back to California, said he's going to start a foundation, was going to put even more money into figuring out what would work. But far too little attention, it seems to me, has been paid to the result of that 5 years on the children and on the parents and communities and neighborhoods in Newark. It's fine that he and the rest of the folks, the consultants, most of the money was spent on consultants and on back pay for teachers to negotiate a new teacher contract. So that's fine that those people got taken care of, but it really is time that we ask if those methods, in fact, help the children in the schools the money's being spent on.
Do you spend time in the book on successful models of raising achievement through integration or through other means?
Yeah. So the thing that we know works, like the thing that's undeniable, we have no interest in it, but it works, is integration, right? Racial and economic integration, all the boats rise when it's done well. But we just don't want to do that. And the courts are not making us do that anymore. And so one of the things, there are two things that I say we should really pay some attention to. One is having consequences, making it illegal, making it difficult to spend taxpayer money in ways that are simply not working, consistently are not working. That we as taxpayers, you know, need to become involved. It's a matter of democracy. It's a matter of not just money, but money and democracy. But the things that I really say, if we are committed to segregated education, which it arguably we are, why not have all of these billionaires and politicians and communities and nonprofits and venture capital folks with their deep, deep, deep pockets actually focus on educational strategies that we know work, like the strategies that are used in high achieving wealthy schools. So, for example, classrooms are generally small. Teachers are highly educated. If you go to a private school where Zuckerberg's kids or Bill Gates's kids or Betsy DeVos's kids are educated, and you were to tell them, we are going to stock your schools with teachers who have been educated, who taught how to teach for 5 weeks and will only be here for 2 years, there'd be an uprising. And so I'm saying, if we actually took if the goal is not to make money for companies, is not the bottom line, is not to use poverty and dispossession as a growth strategy, then give these same children, use that money to give them what your children have. And that just doesn't seem that difficult to me.
Where does the money intersect with integration? Because one could argue that, yeah, do all those things, small class size, high qualification standards for teachers, well-funded materials, et cetera. And then, you know, black parents might say, you know, if you do that, I don't need white people in my kids' classrooms in order for them to succeed. Not that they'd be against it, but that shouldn't be a qualification.
Right. Well, one of the things I talk about in the book are, which we rarely hear, this is interesting, I recognize that I so rarely hear about success stories in traditional public schools. where you have these sort of high flying numbers around kids going to college and not dropping out. And so some of the independent means, like from the 1970s on, there's a score, literally there's 450 examples of Black independent schools, Latino independent schools, and Native American independent schools that did amazing stuff within the for students who were struggling within the context of, you know, these are kids who are at poverty levels, living in neighborhoods of social dysfunction, and who, when they tell the story from the 70s on of these segregated spaces that were dedicated to high quality and to their political education, I mean, that's one thing. People really did talk to them about the politics around them, what they've gone on, who they've gone on to be and do. And so one of the things I say is it's not rocket science. We have a map of schools. Both in contemporary periods, just recently there was a school in D.C., a public high school, where the students in the eighth grade looked around and said, every time we turn around, what we're hearing is, you know, that our schools are bad. It's the charter schools that are good. It's private schools that are good. We've decided we're going to all, 100% of us are going to graduate from college. And the students approached the staff and the faculty with this as a project 4 years ago. And they said, would you tell us what we need to do? And in the summer of 2016, 100% of those children graduated and they did it themselves. Right. Those are stories, though, we need to hear more of, because otherwise you would think that nothing good is actually happening anywhere but in a certain segment of the education industry.
We'll continue in a minute with Cornell American Studies Director Noliwe Rooks. Her new book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Stay with us.
A mandate to some is a tax to others.
Rather than buy the insurance that supposedly we want them to buy, we overprice it and then we penalize them when they can't afford it. So we are going to repeal the tax on poor Americans.
Senate Republicans now say they'll scrap the individual mandate for health insurance and work it into their tax bill. We've got that story, plus how we reached $1.7 trillion in tax cuts. That's next time on The Takeaway, weekday afternoons at 3 on 93.9 FM.
WNYC is supported by Hospital for Special Surgery, ranked the number one hospital in America for orthopedics for 8 consecutive years by U.S. News & World Report, now open in Westchester. Learn more at hss.edu/westchester. The Museum of the City of New York, located at 103rd and 5th, home to New York at its core, an interactive exhibition exploring New York City's past, present, and imagining its future, opens 7 days a week, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. You value the programs you hear on WNYC. That's why you're listening right now. So are thousands of others, people who would learn about your business on our air. Learn more about corporate sponsorship at wnyc.org/sponsor.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and Tish in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Professor Rooks. Hi, Tish.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks.
I'm so pleased to hear your guest and what she has to say. Can't wait to read her book. I have a question first about you. You started off talking about the criteria for success nowadays. So I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about changing that conversation. Well, first, what are the segronomics of, you know, classifying success by testing? Because I think that's a big part of the conversation that's overlooked in our society nowadays. And in the bigger picture also, what would the segronomics look like if there were no private schools, if everybody in our country had to go to public schools and therefore they had to be well-funded in the things you're talking about?
Thank you for those questions. And we're running out of time already. We've got about 5 minutes. So brief answer, as brief as you can for complicated questions like that.
So testing is actually one of the things that I talk about that I think is important is to look at how we arrived at the point with No Child Left Behind, where testing at the federal level, at least, was aggressively expanded, and the rhetoric around why it was expanded like that and who it ended up benefiting. Within the $500 to $600 billion a year education budget, testing is about 25% of that, and the numbers of players who have jumped in to that realm in order to get a piece of that business, but have not necessarily delivered, is absolutely a part of what I'm talking about with Segronomics.
David in South Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hey, big fan of the show. I think what you guys are doing is great.
Thank you.
Moved my family from Brooklyn out to South Orange, New Jersey, and moved in the middle of the year, and my children were, we didn't have a choice as to which elementary school our kids were going to go to. And they were put in the predominantly non-white, I'm white, my children are white, non-white school. South Orange and Maplewood is one of the most liberal areas in New Jersey. Nancy Solomon from NPR is out there. There are more Black Lives Matter signs in people's front yards and rainbow flags on the front of people's houses.
I'm going to rush you for time.
I just want to make the point that if the liberal left doesn't realize that better education for all children, the amount of racism that I'll see come out when someone says, oh, and you're keeping your child in that school, or, oh, I know you didn't have a choice when you first moved, but you are going to move them into a better school, aren't you?
Well, what is your experience in the school?
It's a great school. I love that my children are being raised somewhat colorblind, but we don't have as much money in our PTA. There's a movement right now to have all the PTAs from all the schools in the district have their money be put into one pot and then spread evenly amongst the schools. And what I thought were these great liberals that I live around are fighting it.
Dave, I'm going to leave it there and get a response before we run out of time. And I do see that in your book, Professor Rooks, you have a stat that 75% of white parents, tell me if I'm misinterpreting this, support school integration and sending their kids to schools that are more than 50% black. Why don't we hear those stories, and what do those stats mean in relation to David's story?
Right. Well, the thing is, I think with David's story, it actually the rest of that section talks about how, yes, we believe in it on paper. What we do not believe in are the ways that we achieve it. So we like the idea of integrated schools. We are, you know, perfectly happy to think, you know, everybody benefits with some integration. Where you start to have a problem is when you say, well, how much integration is integration? For some, if it's a class of 20 kids and you've got two kids of color, one black, one Latino, you're integrated, you're good. The numbers drop if you start to talk about, you know, 50-50. More to the point, again, given the neighborhood segregation that we are currently facing, it's an intervention in order to achieve racial and economic. I really want to hold on to it. It's not just racial integration that we're lacking in; it's economic integration as well. And if we had to raise taxes to do that, if we had to bus some kids to do that, if we had to fund some special programs for certain kids and not others, that's when we run into trouble, and that's when the Supreme Court gets involved, and that's when people say, but you're being unfair to me. I want integration, but as a white parent, I don't want to feel like I'm having to give up anything to achieve it.
Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell, now the author of Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Thank you so much.
Thank you.